Yo, you know what it is, you know what time it is, you know what day it is. It is Wednesday. What is this? Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. You are now tuned in to WKYA Radio Podcast, the only official hip hop podcast dedicated to the people, for the people, and by the people. And today, our topic, let me give you a little brief synopsis on our topic while I get everything set up. The question was posed after watching a couple of flicks on YouTube and a documentary, what is black art, okay? And I sat there and I thought to myself, what is black art? I asked myself, you know, what is black art? And I think that's what's going to be, that's going to be our topic today, is what is black art? And of course, as always, is my other, my lovely other half, Miss Perfect Peace. Hello, my dear.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you today?
Hi, flying as always. You know how I do what I do.
And you do it so well. I like the topic today. What is black art?
Well, that's a good question. And we're going to spend the first portion of the show. I actually got a hold of a speech or a conversation from James Baldwin called Being Black in America. So we're going to check that out for a while. Y'all going to tune in to WKYA if y'all want to get some knowledge and y'all want to express some knowledge. You can always call in at 516-418-5822. Again, that number is 516-418-5822. And we're going to get into, actually, no, let's wait. Let's get into some music. I got some music I want to play first before we get into that conversation, because it's a tad bit long, but I got some good music I want to get into first. So, with this first track, of course, some good music is what we're going to play. That's all we do around here. You're now tuned in to WKYA, the only real hip-hop podcast out there. Holla at your boy. Peace.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fishing the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. Shine, you know how I feel. Spend all the time, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine.
Incomparable, untouchable Nina Simone. Man, I can't even talk about how much she didn't. Man, I don't even want to get into that whole other show. But anyway, she's part of today's show, but I mean, just to talk about her alone would be a show. But anyway, we're gonna get some questions out before we get this conversation with James Baldwin, because we want to find out what actually black art is to everybody else. So, the question is being posed to our listeners and hosts. I'm going to let you answer this question first. What is black art?
Black art can be subjective depending on where you are in your own blackness, I mean, so to speak. It could be something from an elite perspective to where it's this art piece that's done, and it could be a dot in the middle of a black screen. And for some reason, for the elite black, that is amazing art. Versus it could be kids at a fire hydrant in New York playing around a fire hydrant, and it could be a photograph that captures the essence of that culture. That's black art. But understanding the whole premise of it is understanding when you're capturing blackness within your art, whether it's in canvas or in photography or sculpture or anything like that, what the question is, what is it speaking to for the culture and the people? That's black art.
Okay. All right. That's very deep. I mean, you could have just been like, said black art was fucking my answer, but okay. I guess to me, black art would be... It's not what it would be. I guess the better question is, what is not black art, so to speak? Like, to me, black art would be Pam Grier and James Baldwin and Madam C.J. Walker, Shirley Chisholm. Black art, to me, is almost anything we create, because I look at it as being anything we create from the soul. And art is something that comes from the soul. So whether it is tricking out a car or, you know, designing a bedroom, anything, I believe anything we do is black art, because we do it with a certain amount of je ne sais quoi. You know what I'm saying? And it's part of the reason why America, not so to speak, it is what it is, but it kind of is. Like, The seasoning, the flavor, and the characteristics that you get in America, they got from us. I just believe that we gave America its soul, its flavor. You know what I'm saying? So I mean, it's kind of hard for me to look around and see white kids and white people with locks and think that they just came up with that idea on their own. It's hard for me to see. It's hard for me to accept groups like Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and 98 Degrees and all these so-called boy bands, which are really white placations of R&B. So for me to say... For me to look at that and not say that's black art, it is, because they say the imitation of art is the greatest flattery. So for Elvis Presley to basically mimic his whole routine after Little Walter is black art, because he knew he had no individual creativity, talent whatsoever. So what did he do? He mimicked somebody who did have some.
But see, I have to disagree with you, hubby, because this is the thing. Yes, in its essence, it's black art, but black art only can come from black people. Everybody else is an imitation.
Yeah.
And the reason, and if they're imitating to make a dollar, then all they're doing is appropriating the culture itself. So that's not black art. That's appropriation
to
black art.
That's true. That is true. I mean, okay, let's put it like this. The Chinese food we eat over in America isn't real Chinese food, but we call it Chinese food, don't we?
Agree.
Exactly. Everything we got in America is not original, but we call it that. So you have to be honest and say, even though, like you said, black art has to come from a black creator, when you see other cultures doing what we created, you have to have some acknowledgement. Okay, that's black art, because that's where they got that from. They didn't just wake up and say, you know what, I'm going to twist my hair, knowing it won't lock, knowing it's not going to hold, but I know what it's going to take for me to get my hair to do this. No. They don't wake up just knowing that shit, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, I guess I look at it like, I say it's black art because even if it's imitation, you imitate it,
but
black art.
That equates to envy, though. If a white woman sees me with my hair braided, she's like, ooh, I like that, and I want to have that. We can take, what's her name, the coming out of the water with her hair braided, and all of a sudden braids became this thing and that was unique and urban for the white woman. Was it Jane Fonda? That's envy. That's envy.
Yeah.
And to me, in my mind, is that whatever they do, they can appreciate black art when it comes from black artists. But when they take it, make it their own, and they try to rebrand it for their own, that is not black art.
That's true. That's true. I'll give you that. It's really not. It's not. Let's see. I got a little something called Democracy is Hypocrisy. Let's check this out right quick. Let's take a break. It's WKYA Radio. We off in the building. 516-418-5822 if you want to call in and join the conversation. What is black art? Before we go, if you're buying a home and you have a home, or you're selling a home and you need to get that home refurbished or certified or whatever you need to do, I have the perfect people that you need to go see. JPJ, which is my homeboy from, man, way back in the day. JPJ, what is it? I think it's JPJ Inspections. He and my other homeboy from school is JPJ Home Inspections, 678-469-2009. If you're buying a home or selling a home and you want to get your home certified for the market, or you just want to get your home up and ready and safety certified and inspected, give my man over a call, JPJ Home Inspections, 678-469-2009. Ask for Javon. Tell him Supreme over at WKYA sent you. WKYA in the building. Man, we're talking about what is black art. 516-418-5822.
Don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault.
What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim. And then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him.
Yes, sir.
This is American justice.
Yes, sir.
That's right.
This is American democracy.
Yes,
and those of you who are familiar with it,
yes,
know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
Right.
Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail.
Right.
But if you can't prove that a democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
This is true, that you belong where white people have put you. It is only since the Second World War that there's been a counter image in the world, and that image not come about through any legislation on the part of any American government, but through the fact that Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world. And Africans had to be dealt with in a way they'd never been dealt with before. This gave an American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself beyond a savage or a clown. It has created, and will create, a great many conundrums. One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, that is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. What is crucial here is that unless we can manage to establish some kind of dialogue between those people whom I pretend have paid for the American dream and those other people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble. I want to say at the end, at the last, is that that is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room, and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized. And we can talk to each other, at least on certain levels, so that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment, or at least our politeness, has some effect on the world. It may not. I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America, we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn in which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation and in spite of the Johnson landslide is the one that's been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years. It seems to me that the city of New York, for example, this is my last point, has had Negroes in it for a very long time. If the city of New York were able, as it has indeed been able, in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, tear down buildings and raise great new ones, downtown and for money, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects in the ghetto for the Negroes. And of course, the Negroes hate it. Presently, the property does indeed deteriorate because the children cannot bear it. They want to get out of the ghetto. If the American pretensions were based on more solid, a more honest assessment of life and of themselves, it would not mean for Negroes, when someone says urban renewal, that Negroes simply are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it does mean now. This is not an act of God. We're dealing with a society made and ruled by men. If the American Negro had not been president in America, I am convinced that the history of the American labor movement would be much more edifying than it is. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes, when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America, I am not an object of missionary charity, I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
All right. That was James Baldwin speaking on the, I guess, the conditions that it would concern for us to have a black president, which is ironic because we've had a black president. We've had more than one. I don't know if people know, before George Washington, we had a black president. I forgot his name. My uncle told me who it was, and I forgot. But before the Constitution, there was a black man who was said to be head of state. This is prior to the Constitution. I'll look it up and try to get back with you on the next show. But, and then also, I don't know if y'all know this, Abraham Lincoln was black. His mother was a slave. I guess that would make Obama a third black president. But for you liberals and Republicans out there, we don't want to put y'all in the uproar. We're just going to say that was our first black president. But after listening to what James Baldwin was speaking about, do you have any remarks? Do you have anything you want to add to, or, you know, anything, any way that made you feel?
For me, it's just the importance of understanding what his words were then and what it means for us now. It's always good to go back and reflect on the people of our people in past generations and their words, and how that can serve as a warning. It can serve as motivation. It can serve something spiritual to get you motivated to be a better person in your own community for our people. That's all I have.
Okay. I think for the most part, what I it is a situation of it's kind of hard to say. It's not that I don't have the words. It's just there's so many ways to say this. It's like the fear of black success is equatable to the fear, not necessarily the fear of black success in America is equatable to how scientists feel when that mouse escapes the maze. You have that sense of regret because this rodent has figured out something that probably most humans couldn't, but at the same time, if you consider that rodent to be property, then you have the option of saying, I'm proud to see my this or this succeed. And that's how America views black people. We're subject to be property. When we're successful, oh, we're proud of our black Americans. They provide so much and add so much to the country. But then there's that percentage of black America that they want to shun and turn their back on, or even, I mean, let's just say, who do you think fills most of these prisons? Those black men that America has basically written off and probably are going to keep writing off, because just like a tax write-off, those prisons being full mean money. Black. And to me, that is the reverse side of black art. Because if you've ever been to prison and you see the shades of black men that are in there, it's amazing. Like, it's just, I don't even know what to say. I don't. Let's go on to this next track. My man Herbie Hancock, Watermelon Man. It's a classic old school joint, man. I'm always going to put y'all on to some new old school shit because I know y'all don't have no history. If y'all did, man, we would be in a totally different position. It's your boy Stash Madison, WKYA Radio, 516-418-5822 to call in during the conversation. Again, it's 516-418-5822, WKYA Radio. Peace.
Thank you.
All right, all right. Before we go, you want to send out your socials, your media, you know. Oh, let them know about your new venture that you got going on.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I'm a coffee lover. I love coffee. I'm one of those people who migrated from drinking coffee with cream and sugar to straight black, a nice black cup of coffee. You can check out my coffee selection and different blends at The Perfect, P-E-R-F-E-K-T, Perk, P-E-R-K.com. So that is theperfectperk.com.
Also, if you spend, what is it, spend $19.99,
you get 10% off the second bag.
Okay. You heard it here first, people. Theperfectperk.com. Check them out. The P-E-R-F-E-K-T, perk.com. All right, your man, Stash Madison. It has been a joy. We're going to close out the show with our man, James Baldwin, dropping some serious knowledge on us. Thank y'all for tuning in. As always, we'll be back next Wednesday, the same time, same bat channel. Y'all stay live. Stay safe. Stay the fuck away from me. WKYA. Holla at your boy. One love. Peace.
Well, then, you are not hopeful about integration in the southern United States, even if it comes. Am I right?
That is not quite what I mean. Let me put it another way. All right? In the first place, it is not a southern problem. It is a national problem. What is happening in New Orleans today began to happen over 100 years ago when, in effect, the North, which was the government, having freed tens of thousands of illiterate black men, they made no provision for them, none whatever, none whatever. They were dumped on the body politic, and no one was responsible for them. And they were, of course, immediately political and industrial footballs for everybody. They were everybody's target. Because, after all, they had to go to school. Now, they got to go to school after Booker T. Washington in 1895, who was the architect, really, of the separate but equal principle, said, in effect, said exactly, education will not make us different. Education will not make us, will not give us any desire to become equal to you. That in all things social, we can be as separate as the fingers, and all things essential and mutual progress, we can be as one as the hand. Now, this idea was accepted by the nation, not only by the South.
But the South refused to provide the Negroes with the kind of educational facilities that the North more or less made available to them.
No, this is not true either. I'm afraid that is not the way it happened. That is not the way it happened. What happened is the Negro education began, and really began in the South, and is still very largely located there. There are Negro universities in the South. There are very few Negro universities in the North, because the North is technically not segregated. But it is very difficult, on the other hand, you know, to enter. I don't mean it's difficult because the law is against it or any of these things. I mean, it is a complex of things. I grew up in Harlem. So naturally, I went to Harlem schools. Had to go to Harlem schools. There were the only schools, you know, in my neighborhood. You know?
Yeah.
You grow up, if you're an American Negro, no matter where you live in the country, you are living in a segregated community. The South has, you know, all those things we know about in the South, and in every great northern city has its ghetto. And I know how difficult it is to get out of these ghettos because I was born in one.
Well, James, are you suggesting then that, in effect, officially, in the South, there is inequality and no freedom for the Negro, and unofficially, but just as effectively, there is no freedom for the Negro in the North?
The terms are different, but the reality is the same. A boy in Birmingham is in great trouble in Birmingham. He has, in a way, one advantage, though. It's very clear in Birmingham that he can't go anywhere. A boy born in New York can go almost anywhere.
Almost.
Almost. This can drive you mad. This can drive you mad. You can live almost anywhere. if you fight to get in. You can enter almost any nightclub. You can enter almost any bar, and nothing will happen. But this almost means that there is a bar, there is a hotel, there is a doorman, there is an elevator boy, there is somebody every day. There is that one place you cannot go, which means you enter every door on edge. Now, this is not true in the South. When a Negro boy goes into the Woolworths in the South, sits down, he knows very well what he's up against. He knows they don't want him there, and the only way that he can stay there is to say, in effect, what they have said, you know. We not only are entitled to service, but we want it.
Yes, but there's more and more of this going on in the South. Negro boys are going into Woolworths. They're going on buses, not only Negro boys, Negro girls. And they're insisting on their right to sit anywhere in a bus or sit. They're insisting on their right to sit down at the counter. They're refusing to sit in colored waiting rooms only and bus depots and things like that. They are insisting on a change in this condition.
They are indeed. I'm sorry.
Well, doesn't this suggest a change and progress in the relations and in the status of the Negro in these areas?
It may or may not mean that, but what it does mean, this is why the South is so panic-stricken, and essentially the country is so panic-stricken about it, means this. The generation of boys and girls who are sitting down on those lunch counters are the first generation of Negroes in the entire history of America who were not controlled by the Americans' image of them. This is why Montgomery is so demoralized, Little Rock is so paralyzed, New Orleans, people are going mad. I was in Montgomery after the bus boycott, after it succeeded, which outlawed segregation on the buses. Now, Montgomery is really, after all, a rather small southern town. If you can find anywhere in the deep South, Negroes, the South has been saying for generations, they know the Negro. You would find them in that town. There was not a Negro in that town, really, essentially, who was not working with some white man. There was really no middle class. There were no outside agitators. These people walked. These people terrified, the town is still terrified. Because they don't, not even on the obvious level about violence. If they're not who I thought they were, who are they?
Well, who did the whites, southern and northern, think the Negroes were? What is this image that you were talking about?
This is precisely what it's so difficult to get down to, but let me try to put it this way. What is he? I don't know what white people see, you know, when they look at a Negro anymore. But I do know very well. I realized when I was very young that whatever he was looking at, it wasn't me. It was something he was afraid of. It was something to which he was attracted or which he found repulsive, but it wasn't me. I was not a man. Now, this image, I don't know what this image is, but it has something to do. It has something to do, I'm convinced of this, with the Puritan God. It has something to do with a peculiar and, I believe, absolutely bankrupt morality under which we all are suffering. The one person who was outside this constriction in fact and historically and in life was this pagan, this black pagan.
Who was brought over...
Was brought over.
Chattel.
That's right. Was brought over as a chattel to God's country. Now, somewhere, I think in order to deal with it all, we've got to go all the way back to the beginning and try to imagine. I don't know how. I don't know if this can be done, but I think we've got to try what it must have been like then, because then, after all, he really was a pagan. He had nothing to do. Not only with the standard, you know, the puritanical standards of America, but with the European tradition out of which Americans came. He really was a stranger. He really did frighten them. They did not know what to do with him. And they still don't. And in a way, the sexual legends which have sprung up around the figure of the Negro in America contain somehow the key, the truth about our situation. It is still true. That the question which ends the argument, stops the argument, is would you let your sister marry one? It is still the question to which, in effect, the country has found no answer.
Do you think that there is this pretense? The thing that impresses me while I try to understand the problem of the relationship of white and Negro in the United States, which seems to me a very crucial problem indeed, is the earnest desire of what I can only call Christian-thinking Americans to remedy this terrible, enduring wrong, to find some way to make expiation, to find some way to give the Negro equality as a citizen of that country. Surely this is the real significance, for example, behind this whole struggle for integration.
I quite agree with that. I quite agree with that. But in order for this to be achieved, there is one thing which has to be done which is not being done. And that is this. It is not a question of giving the Negro equality. That is not really the question. The question is why you haven't.
Why you haven't?
Yes. Why doesn't he have it yet? This question is important. This question implies, how can I put this? That in order to deal with it, really deal with it, you have to first deal with yourself. I know a great many very well-meaning and very admirable people who work, let us say, in settlement houses, all up and down, you know. Now, with very rare exceptions, they do not really make contact with the people they are trying to help precisely because they think they are trying to help them. And the problem is more crucial and more subtle than that. A Negro boy dealing with a white school teacher doesn't want to be helped that way. He wants to be accepted. He has to be accepted as a boy, as a person.
As a human being.
That's right. Before anything can be done with him. He cannot be handled as a problem. It's not a question of giving you Negro equality. It's a question of making the country grow up. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but do I draw the conclusion from this fairly? That what you're saying is that in some peculiar way, there is a need on the part of the American to feel, the white American, to feel that the Negro American is a dependent, that there is a need to put the American Negro in a place apart?
Mm-hmm. That is one of the things I mean. I also mean to imply something else. Let me put it personally. It's the safest way to put it. There is something in me, for example, you know, sometimes, and certainly when I was much younger, which resented the assumption on which all these things are based. It assumes that you have something I want. It somehow assumes that I have not been to your wedding and haven't made my own judgments about the marriage. What makes you think, after all, I've often felt like saying, that I want to get into the white man's world. Look at it.
But you are part of that world.
Oh, of course. Everyone is. There's no way I know. But I am trying to point out this, that there really isn't on the basis of it. Just looking at the evidence. Any reason for white people to assume the Negroes want to be like them? In fact, on the basis of the evidence, one will conclude that anybody in his right mind would do his best not to become like that.
Well, the situation has changed in this respect, surely. That whereas before, your American Negro depended on the NCAAP.
NAACP.
I'm sorry, NAACP, to conduct legal battles for him on a very small level.
And that's much more complex than that.
Well, if I may just finish this point. That whereas before he depended upon that kind of organization, or he accepted the Booker T. Washington proposition, give me equal but separate facilities and I will be happy. Today, he will not accept.
Cannot.
Cannot accept that.
Cannot.
Now, isn't this a qualitative change in the entire situation?
Yes, but you must remember what I'm trying to convey. Because I'm not arguing that the situation has changed. I'm not even arguing, you know, that progress has been made. I'm not questioning the goodwill, you know, of the people who are doing it, mm-hmm. or helping to do it. This is not the question. What I'm trying to get at is this. All right, that's true. But you, oneself, the boy, the girl, no, is in fact living in a house. house that he can't move out of because he's black.
But there is surely an end to these wretched and miserable and degrading stereotypes that I was brought up on as a white person, and all of us were brought up on who are white. The Step and Fetchets, the Bojangles Robinsons, the Aunt Jemimas, all the Octavius Roy Cohn stories and all the rest
this
of it.
Is
all
in,
of this is gone.
This is incontestable. But what has come to take its place is not truer. It is still an image which is still designed not to reveal the truth, but to hide it.
A Belafonte, a James Baldwin, a Ralph Ellison,
well,
a Lorraine Hansberry are not closer to revealing the truth?
Well, now, Ralph and Lorraine and myself are not performers.
All right, let's drop Belafonte. Let's move into the world of letters.
All right, all right. But before we drop Belafonte, let me say this. Harry, you know, is also, I think, you know, a very, obviously, you know, one of the most talented people around. And knows exactly what he's doing, and has great, and he is very important. He's even very important from a point of view of morale building among Negro kids. He's very important. And yet, Harry, I have a feeling, must work within the psychological, emotional framework of the country. Now, you cannot be Belafonte and not know, after all, why people come to see you, and not know what it really is that's happening between you and your audience. But if we examine, and I think later on we should do that, try to, what is really happening, I think we will find that, again, the image has not changed in some way. It is not that Belafonte is, it is not so much that this particular man is being accepted, though this is true, but what is really crucial is that something else, and something in the white world, I mean, has failed. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I follow that. All right, then how about our writers?
Ralph, Lorraine, I. What one's trying to do, and the reason Lorraine's play is really important, the reason, you know, that Invisible Man is such an important achievement, is because it is the first time, almost the first time, I think probably the very first time, that a Negro has managed to achieve to step out of the image...
out of the cage?
Out of the cage, really. Now, let's compare this. This is arbitrary. I don't mean to be unjust, but I think that we can do it this way. I admire, you know, the late Richard Wright very much. But there, at the heart of Native Son, which is a very important novel, the central figure, Bigger Thomas, is really a white man's idea of a Negro. Now, because after all, what does happen is that the Negro takes the image which he's offered and believes it himself. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Ralph did in Invisible Man was very, very different. It was very, very different. And superficially, perhaps, you know, the novels may seem to have a great deal in common, but the great break between them is that Ralph dealt with his people and this boy from the inside and was no longer being described in any way whatever, really, by other people, but was imposing his definition of himself on the world. All the time we know about, really, all the time that matters to us, Negroes, black men, have been described by white people. In order for the Negro slave to become an American, he had to accept all the definitions which were offered him, the language, the psychology, the theology, the morals, everything. He was defining himself in terms of someone else's definition. It is very important when the day comes, and instead of being defined by others, you are able to define yourself, and the threat, which is always what is felt, now, the people have been describing you, is that if you can describe yourself, then you can describe them. And if you can describe them, what would you say? And in the case of the American Negro describing white people, one can see, I think, how great the panic might be.
Why?
Well, what would I have to say about...
American liberalism.
Yes, what would I really have to say about... if I were going to describe... I can't name names, so... A hypothetical white liberal. Well, I know what he thinks he's doing. But what he's mainly doing is something which demands my tacit cooperation. I have to agree that I am what he says I am in order for us to have any dialogue at all. Now, if I don't agree that he is what he thinks I am, then inevitably, and one sees this at once in the face of the people you're dealing with, it means that if I'm not what he takes me to be, that means I have a standard of judgment which is not his, which I may then be using to judge him.
And which may cut the ground from under all the standards.
All the other, yeah, exactly.
Do you regard this as a distinct threat to the, what shall I call it, the sense of spiritual security, America?
I think the Americans essentially, I don't think this, I know this. Yes, this is a threat to the American personality as it has so far been constituted. It's a threat to their definition of the world. It is a threat to the way they think reality is. For example, this may seem extremely far-fetched, but let's think about this for a minute. It has very often seemed to me that the American notion of the world, which makes it so simple, things are black or white, things are good or bad, people are straight or crooked, and life is not like that. I mean, anybody who begins to grow up knows that life is not like this at all. It seems to me that it's a reflection, a direct reflection, of the effort made by the white American to keep away, to not be threatened by black people. In some way, the American vision of the world is all wrapped up with their vision of black men, which has to do with their vision of themselves. Black is evil. The saved are white. Now, there is certainly a thread which connects this reality to, which makes it possible for the Secretary of State to say, we will not do business with the devil. You see what I mean? Let me try to do it again. I was saying before that in a way black men were very useful to the American because in a country so absolutely undefined, so amorphous, where there were no limits, no height really, and no depth, there was one thing which one could be certain. One knew where one was by knowing where the Negro was. You knew that you were not on the bottom.
Because the Negro was there.
You knew, one knows what sin is in the same way. One knows what danger is in the same way. When I said this face is invested with all the vices and all the sanctities, which people are afraid, that is one of the things I meant. Now, this implies a vision of oneself, it seems to me, and a vision of the world which doesn't stop at the American borders. It is also the way America deals with the world. And the world is much more complex than black or white.
Let me ask you this question, then, Jim, because it seems to me we've been moving in the direction of it and then retreating at its implications. If such issues as the fight for desegregation and integration are mere manifestations of what is really a subterranean and basic conflict, how is this conflict going to be met? On what level is it going to be met? How is it going to be resolved? If all of these steps are mere incidental steps rather than essential ones.
Now, all of these steps, I don't think any of these steps can be called incidental. They're all essential. They are steps in this direction, though. What has to happen? I think Martin Luther King, in some mysterious way, has really knows what it is. What he has done, it seems to me, for the first time, is to make that problem, the Negro problem, a matter of moral self-examination. He has made it more difficult than it was before to evade it by good works. the internal revolution that he has begun in must, cannot possibly avoid moving directly into the heart of the people who make up America. I mean that the problem will never be resolved until everybody in the country, in some way, I know how impossible this sounds, however, this is what has to happen, is able, is somehow enabled to do without this crutch. Because the other side of the difficulty, and it's very difficult, I have said in effect that white men must give up what is in effect a crutch.
That's right.
So must I. This is entirely true. There is something very safe about being a Negro in a way, because you can blame anything that happens to you on it. And this is the worst thing about being a Negro, quite apart now from New Orleans, race riots, lynchings, et cetera, et cetera. The worst thing about it is at one point somewhere in yourself, you have to realize that, all right, you are a Negro and this is all true, but before that, you are a man and your life is in your hands. You are responsible for what happens to you. You cannot blame anybody for it. There is no point. There is no one to blame.
You speak about this radical reconstitution of the entire social fabric of a country, of a more than reorientation of a relationship between two peoples existing in this one country, and must become one inevitably. You suggest that the difficulties standing in the way of it are enormous, even though some important but not vastly significant progress has been made. Let me ask you a direct question. Under the circumstances, in your heart, aren't you basically very pessimistic about the future for the Negro in the United States?
No.
No?